Hello and welcome to the Hornets and Heartbreak podcast. My name is Mark Bernacki and I'm here with my co-host, Tim Rogers. What's up, Tim?
What it do, Liquor Mark?
I'm doing pretty well, man. We are joined today by Ben Golliver from the Washington Post. This is becoming a bit of an annual tradition when the Hornets lose in the play-in tournament. We have no idea what to talk about, so we asked Ben to come on. Thanks for joining today, Ben.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So you guys are inviting me to dance on the grave? Is that what we're doing today, or you got other plans?
I would love to hear your takes of dancing on the Hornets' grave, actually.
Yeah, so Tim and I did an emergency podcast last week where we talked about James Borrego being fired. Both of us were surprised by the news, but Ben, we're interested to get your takes from, you know, a national media perspective. How surprised were you about that? And, you know, what do you think about it? Was it a good decision?
Well, first of all, I hadn't thought a ton about where he stood with that organization for a little while. So I guess it came out of left field to me a little bit, just because it wasn't necessarily like front and center on my radar screen, like I'm sure it was for you guys. But as I was thinking about it, I wasn't that surprised. To me, it just kind of boils down fundamentally. I always thought James Borrego was sort of a stickler. Like, he's kind of from that Spurs tree, older school, accountability. You know, he's always very careful kind of with what he says in the media, or if he wants to make a point, he does so, but he's not loose-lipped, right, in any way. And you kind of contrast that with the main player on the roster, with LaMelo Ball, who you're obviously going to be building around here for the next 5 to 10 years. And he's about as loosey-goosey as there is a person in the NBA at this point. I mean, he's free-flowing. And you even look at kind of their track records to how they get towards the NBA. Like, LaMelo is just all talent, right? It's all hype. I mean, he's been a famous reality TV show since he was, 14 years old or whatever. Can you guys imagine James Borrego as a teenager starring in a reality TV show with his family members? I'm guessing not, right?
Yeah.
So it always felt like a pretty distinct, I don't want to call it a clash, but a differences of personality, right? And you guys will remember early in the season when the Hornets came to LA, there was this little like post-game kerfuffle where James Borrego had kind of said, hey, you know, he wants LaMelo to show some progress, you know, managing late game situations. And then I asked LaMelo about that, and he came back and was like, well, I just need to be on the court, and basically saying like, hey, you know, James Borrego's got, you know, too tight of reins on me, you know, kind of let me loose. And I was surprised by how frank LaMelo was. Maybe I shouldn't have been, you know, he just kind of said it, you know, straight out. Mm-hmm. And the very next night, LaMelo's out there playing, you know, the most minutes he's played all season long, putting up big numbers. And it kind of felt to me like one of those things where, oh, this is the hint of maybe a power struggle, and we know who's going to win on this one. And I think when you're Borrego, your whole case to management and ownership is, hey, I'm the guy who's going to be able to mold these young, talented players into becoming, you know, all around two-way contributors who are going to be, you know, playoff ready. And in that mold of like the Spurs, where everybody's together and they're able to get it done on both ends. And you look at the lack of, you know, team defensive progress, the lack of buy-in defensively from LaMelo, which I thought, you know, especially in the important moments, was just not where it needed to be. And then the lack of progress, obviously, of kind of getting blown out 2 years in a row in the play-in and not making the playoffs. It just gets hard to sort of make your case in that spot. Like, what is your argument to stay, right? If they're seeing there's this clear class of, or clear difference of personalities and no major progress, that starts to be a case to try to find somebody else.
Yeah. LaMelo played 32 minutes per game this season, which I think was the third lowest of like any all-star player. So that's definitely been kind of an issue. It's not always an issue, but in some games you're just like, why is LaMelo not in the fourth quarter? In certain situations, the Hornets did win, you know, 23 games 2 years ago, 33 games last year, and then 43 this year. So that sort of had us thinking that he was not going to be fired. I said on the podcast a couple of weeks ago that there was a 0% chance he was going to be fired. And I clearly was very wrong. I think a lot of, you know, Hornets fans were taken aback by it. But when you start to think about it, it does make more sense. And I think you did a good job laying out just sort of all the reasons. A little bit of a clash between LaMelo and Borrego, although there hasn't been anything too public on that. But he also didn't play any of our rookies this year, Ben. You know, James Bouknight and Kai Jones didn't get like any minutes at all. Bouknight got, you know, played a little bit in the middle of the season, but was completely out of the rotation by the end of the year. And I said this on the last episode, like, when you don't play your rookies, you better make the playoffs.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. And he's coaching for his job. I mean, that's why he's not playing them, right? He's going with the guys he trusts, because he feels like, look, you know, I've got to show results. I've got to make the playoffs. And they wind up coming up, you know, just short, you know, in the standings. But I think realistically, you know, if they had Hayward, I mean, how do you guys feel on that? Like, if Hayward had actually had a healthy season, are they a playoff team? If I'm him, that's probably what grinds my gears maybe more than anything. Is this idea of like, I'm being judged on results. I am, you know, giving more wins than in previous years, even without, you know, the kind of the highest salary guy. And yet I'm being held accountable for that. That would sort of bother me if I was Borrego. But at the same time, when you're looking ahead to like who's going to replace him, you know, if you ask LaMelo, like, what kind of a coach do you want? I mean, I think the joke is like he would just say his dad, you know, right? Or like somebody just lets him do whatever the heck he wants, you know, some other family member. But I don't think he would put together this coaching profile of a guy like Borrego, right? He wouldn't say, oh, I want someone who's going to be really hard on me and like pull me from important moments in games. If I'm not showing the requisite amount of control and discipline on defense, he's going to want somebody who turns him fast and loose, get up and down, you know, kind of showtime ease, and, you know, just kind of let the chips fall where they may and have that kind of really fun and free-flowing style, which they've obviously done quite a bit over these last couple of years. But it almost felt to me like that was going against Borrego's nature in a sense, right? So I could see, you know, LaMelo just wanting a completely different vibe from that group. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if they did have maybe a player-friendlier coach in that spot where they do get some, you know, instant results from him and some of the other younger guys in terms of buy-in. But this is also a two-edged sword. You don't want to go too far with this thing. Like we're looking at Steve Nash right now in Brooklyn, where he's the most player-friendly coach I've ever seen. I mean, this guy just caters to his stars and has for the last couple of years, to the point where he basically lets them choose how many minutes they play and everything else. And it's completely blown up in their face. James Harden gave up on them. Kyrie Irving just decided not to show up for more than half the season. Kevin Durant wants to play so much that he runs himself into the ground and there's no like back check protection against him being exhausted. And to me, those are all kind of coaching issues. So I don't think you want to turn this whole show over to LaMelo, but I do think a new voice that can kind of connect with him and mold him and kind of push him without aggravating him is kind of the right way to go here.
Cool. So that gets us into like the next part of the question. Who do you think, you know, the Hornets should go out and get? There's obviously a lot of candidates, but like what's, you've already answered a little bit, but like, would you go for an older, more like veteran coach or somebody younger? I'm definitely of the opinion that this move would make less sense if we went out and just got another, you know, young coach who doesn't have much experience. I'm looking at like more experienced guys like Frank Vogel, Kenny Atkinson, you know, maybe Quinn Snyder, if he's available. A pipe dream of mine would be Mike D'Antoni, even though that's probably not going to happen, but just somebody who has a little bit more experience and can help the Hornets make the next, you know, push in the playoffs.
Well, the first thing is, you know, you have to be honest about where you stand in the pecking order of the best jobs, right? And so I think, you know, some of those names, no disrespect, I'm not sure they're going to be giving the Hornets a look, right? I think they're probably, you know, a guy like Quinn Snyder, if he's going to leave Utah, I think he's doing that for like a premier prestige job, not Charlotte. And you know, say, well, what holds the Hornets back? I mean, to me, it's ownership, it's commitment, it's resources, right? I mean, does Michael Jordan want to spend huge money on a coach? That seems unlikely to me. You know, and does he really want to go into luxury tax and spend big on his roster and really put together a team that is going to be a perennial contender here these next couple of years? I don't see that either, right? So you're battling some of that, and also just the stigma of being the Hornets and kind of being this mediocre or sub-mediocre team for like the last 10 years. I mean, sometimes that will factor into coaching decisions as well. You know, one name I think you guys might have mentioned recently was Terry Stotts. I don't know if he would take it or if he would be interested or if he's trying to get back in the head coaching game or not. But what's interesting about that, he was the one who shepherded Damian Lillard's career the whole way through in Portland. You know, he had a point guard in Lillard who was great on offense, you know, very dynamic playmaker, below average defender, and just sort of built them up into a perennial winner year after year after year. By building an awesome elite, you know, top three, top two, top one, sometimes offense, and then just trying to get by as well as you can on the defensive end. That's probably going to be the formula for Charlotte here over the next 5 years. And I think when Stotts first got to Portland, I was there and there was a real kind of confusion. This guy seems stiff. He's not very famous. You know, he's not very charismatic in the media, but what he was very honest and clear communicator to his players, and he really earned the trust of that locker room. kept it for almost a decade. All those things to me would be like, those would be pluses. If I'm trying to find somebody who kind of get through to LaMelo, you know, he's not going to necessarily be, you know, this heavy-handed dictator like Rick Carlisle type. But I do think that, you know, he's been around, he's seen it all. He knows what wins. He kind of knows how to manage egos and personalities. And that one was an interesting name that you guys brought up, but I could actually see him having some really relevant work experience and maybe the willingness to go and get himself another job as opposed to, you know, being an assistant or whatever else. But I haven't heard too much on Stotts in terms of what he's looking for recently. You know, if you're asking me like, who's a better fit, Stotts or Vogel? I mean, Vogel, it's a defense first coach, right? I mean, that's a guy who has coached, you know, all NBA level guys the last couple of seasons. That feels more like a clash because now he's like readjusting everything he's trying to do to fit a team with much less talent than the Lakers had during their title run. And a team that really just doesn't have the defensive personnel to play the way that he wants to. So of all these veteran guys, I might be more interested in a Stotts than a guy like Vogel.
Yeah, I'm a big Stotts fan. He's also jokingly referred to him as the Mason Plumlee whisperer. So they've had their time together.
They both have the oval faces too. I mean, don't overlook that, you know. And Terry Stotts is quite tall and quite thin. You know, he could play Mason Plumlee's like dad in a movie, maybe.
Yeah, you know, the movie with LaMelo blowing up as he is, I'm sure that movie is about 3 years down the pipeline, so we'll get Terry invigorated. Frank Vogel is actually someone that I don't want to say I'm very against. It'd be nice if he came, but the funniest outcome, I think, would be if we get Frank Vogel and then the next day we end up making the Russell Westbrook trade. So they have to run it back together and pretend like they don't hate each other. But you know, you made the point about the LeVar joke, and normally that would seem like a joke until you realize that half of the Hornets staff is just Michael Jordan's family.
Right.
And so
right.
Then it almost scares me where like Hoop Central made it, like they put out a tweet and I assumed it was a joke, but there was 5% of my mind that was like, oh my God, that might actually happen.
Well, first of all, on the Westbrook thing, whoever takes the next Lakers job is going to have to know beforehand, are we trading Russ or are we going to be stuck with him? Because I think that completely changes how much money you're asking for. I might ask for double, you know, if Westbrook's part of that package. And then on the flip side, I think Vogel's smart enough to not take any job where Westbrook might get traded into his lap. Or at least, you know, feel it out beforehand to make sure that that reunion, which would be doomed before it started, doesn't happen. You know, who are the other candidates that you guys have looked at? And I'm wondering, should you be considering some of these assistants, maybe first-time candidates? Because the financial and economic aspects right now of the NBA are still influencing decisions. I think last year there was a lot of hoopla about how many first-time head coaches, and in some cases, like first-time Black head coaches, were all hired in the same wave. And I think something to keep in mind is usually, you know, you can be paying first-time head coaches, say, 25 to 30% as much as you might pay an established guy. And when you're going through, you know, two seasons basically without fans or limited fans, when you're a team like Charlotte that doesn't have the extra playoff gate revenue, when you're, you know, maybe not selling out every single night because you're not a, you know, a top contender, those kinds of financial decisions matter. And head coaches are a really good way to save money. I mean, two of the most common ways NBA teams save money are going young with their head coach and going young with their play-by-play broadcaster. You know, it's because like those veteran play-by-play broadcasters can make millions of dollars sometimes if they've been around for 20, 30, 40 years, right? So we'll know a little bit more about how good Michael Jordan actually thinks these Hornets are with which direction he goes with the coach. If he's willing to invest in a former head coach, a guy like Terry Stotts, you know, he's not going to break the bank, but he's certainly going to be more expensive than a first-timer assistant.
Well, I would say also that the decision to, you know, let go of James Borrego shows that he is willing to pay more money than we thought a little bit, because Borrego was just extended last offseason. So he's going to be paying Borrego for a couple of years here with him not being on the team. And that was another reason why we thought that he wouldn't be fired, is that, you know, typically Jordan's not going to pay more money than he has to. And he's doing that with Borrego, at least.
No, it's a good point. And also just keep in mind, I mean, Borrego was basically a first timer, right? And then wasn't he also paying Dunlap for a while there? So I think Michael has patented this strategy of just paying rock bottom for coaches. so that he can fire them whenever he needs to.
It's almost a double-edged sword too, because he hires these coaches that sometimes, like in Dunlap's case, flame out so bad that they don't get the second job. So, like, you know, normally I think the rule of thumb is if you get another contract, another team, that the contract is voided. But Dunlap was so bad that even like Division II colleges were like, nah, like just gonna let this guy wait.
Right. So there's no offset coming, so you can't get the rebate on his next contract. That's a great point. That's how you know a guy is a really bad hire. If you have to pay, if you fire him and have to pay every last dollar of the deal with no offset. Great point.
Yeah, the only guy I've ever seen praise Mark Dunlap was Andrew Bogut, because they had Australian connections. And I heard that and I was like, oh, this is not going to work out.
Do you think James Borrego will get another head coaching position, Ben?
Yeah, I think there's a really good chance. I mean, first of all, keep in mind his youth, and then just keep in mind, you know, his level of connections around the league. The Spurs Mafia is a real deal. It may not happen for him immediately this summer, but I wouldn't write it off. And, you know, we've seen that from, you know, other coaches where it's like the first time he can sell something to his future employers in terms of the improvement and wins that you're talking about. And I think people will be understanding that, like, look, it's Charlotte. You don't expect to go to the Eastern Conference Finals there necessarily. And I think he's well-liked and well-respected, generally speaking. I thought, you know, there was a couple years there where I felt like he was squeezing absolutely everything he could out of the roster. And I wasn't totally sure how he was, you know, winning so many games. And then you look back at some of these players who succeeded under him. I mean, Devontae Graham came from absolutely nowhere, right? I think that LaMelo has blossomed, you know, pretty much right on schedule. Bridges, I mean, you guys can go down the list of players in better than I could, but I feel like he's got a number of, like, hey, you know, I got more out of this guy than anybody could have reasonably expected. And, you know, I think he's regarded as a worker, a very focused and intelligent guy. And I think those things all play in his favor.
Yeah, because I think now there's kind of a revisionist history of, like, well, LaMelo was going to be this good this whole time. But, like, if you remember, like, back to when LaMelo was drafted, a lot of NBA experts were predicting that he would be, like, a bottom five player in the league his first season. Obviously, the potential was there. But, like, I mean, he was supposed to be an absolute nothing as a rookie. Really, it's, like, a negative, almost like RJ Barrett was his first year. You know, obviously both the Martin twins, you have Caleb in Miami looking good. So yeah, I mean, I think you can sell that. I do wonder, as someone that knows more about, you know, the league in general, how much credit do you normally give head coaches to development? Because I know there's a lot of assistant coaches and like full staff dedicated to that. Do you think it's fair to assign him credit?
Yeah, so it's usually a top-down credit on development. So it's like, have you created a culture where young guys are going to be bought in and committed to wanting to work and get better? You know, he's not out there shagging balls 2 hours before games, right? Or like helping the guys, you know, spotting them in the weight room as they're trying to put on more pounds. But it's generally just like, are you keeping your players engaged and progressing in the right direction? And then, you know, does it show up, you know, in the win-loss column, right? And I think that there's been a number of rebuilding situations here in recent years where there just hasn't been that kind of progress. Look at Orlando, right? Look at Houston. I mean, I could see Houston being kind of stuck where they are for a while unless they get a really, really big time player in one of these drafts, right? And you want to avoid that. And I think that's sort of like the strongest thing that Borrego can say is like, look, I inherited a really tough spot. I mean, Kemba's wanting out. He's the only good player basically on the roster at that point. So that means it's time for this crazy, you know, rebuilding situation. And yet in not too long, you know, we built it back up into a team that was respectable and kind of delivered almost on ownership expectations. I mean, that's it's a compelling case. Again, he's not going to be top of the list, but he's going to be in the mix for jobs for sure. You know, if you're one of these teams that hired a first time coach last year, like Orlando, you know, I think that some of these turned out to be really good, you know, like New Orleans and Willie Green has been a smash success, right?
Yeah.
But is Borrego a better coach than some of these other coaches that got hired for the first time last year? I mean, Wes Unseld Jr. in Washington, like, I mean, Borrego has a better track record than those guys so far. And if you fast forward 2 years, you could see him be in the mix for those kinds of jobs if those teams keep just cycling mediocrity, right?
As someone who was kind of excited by Wes Unseld, that hurts, but I do agree.
Well, no shots at him. He's my fellow Johns Hopkins Blue Jay. I'm just saying, like, he had a tough first year, you know, and that could go backwards before it goes forward. And at some point, you know, the bill comes due for a guy in that spot. I mean, it's a very thankless, cutthroat job industry coaching is. And you really have to be a crazy grinder to willingly submit to yourself to a profession that has so little job security.
Yeah, especially if you're one of those first year guys. I mean, you can have one or two or really like one and a half bad seasons and you're kind of out of it for the rest of your life. It's like, yeah, you're going to be a lifetime assistant. It is it is thankless.
All right, let's move on. Let's talk about the playoffs here, Ben. Some stuff that actually matters, you know, in the next couple months. You were at game three of the Celtics versus Nets series. You're going to be at game four tonight. The series has been way less close than I think most people thought it would be. I actually picked the Nets before game one, so I've been pretty shocked at how it's played out. Are we seeing an end of an era here with KD and LeBron sort of out of the playoff picture? We're seeing Jason Tatum and other young stars take a step up. What have your thoughts been on this series, Ben?
Well, there's definitely been sort of a changing of the guard element to this season. You know, the under 30 players just kind of dominated all the major awards races. A lot of the older players from LeBron to KD to Steph even dealt with some injury issues this year that kind of, you know, changed the course of their team seasons. You know, Chris Paul right now and the Suns, they're kind of even, you know, struggling in their first round series. So it definitely feels like there's been a changing of the guard for sure. At the same time with Brooklyn, like, it's hard to say that like they're dead forever, but they have some huge decisions coming up this summer, right? Like, Kyrie Irving is due an extension. He's eligible for one. I mean, do you really want to sign up for more, you know, especially at a big number on a long number of years for the Kyrie Irving experience, which has just been so damaging and demoralizing and exhausting all season long? But you have to, because he's friends with Kevin Durant. So as long as that partnership stays strong, I guess they're going to have to just deal with it. I mean, that's not a very enviable spot for their ownership to be in. And then with Steve Nash, I mean, I don't know what his case is to keep his job. You know, he was supposed to be the guy who connects with the stars, you know, makes them comfortable, creates this loose and free atmosphere. And, you know, it's all like basketball Eden. And instead, it's been the seventh layer of hell. All these guys look miserable after these games, even before the games. They don't look like they're having any fun whatsoever. And obviously, Boston's really thumping them. But this is not at all the vision of what basketball under Steve Nash was supposed to be. And Harden goes, so you don't really have the super team label anymore. You can't even get Ben Simmons on the court. You know, to me, they're probably going to have a fall guy. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if it was Steve Nash this summer. And if I was the Nets, what I would be trying to do is find a coach who can manage Kevin Durant's minutes like Greg Popovich managed Tim Duncan's minutes, because this guy's flat out exhausted. He's playing 40 plus for a lot of the season. He, you know, is at times playing 50 plus in last year's playoffs. That is not sustainable. That's going to run Kevin Durant into the ground. And you want to make sure you can have good basketball from him, respectable basketball from him for the next 5 years, not trying to treat this on a day-by-day approach, which is sort of how Nash tends to handle it. You know, it's like anytime he's in a problem situation, he just heaps more burden onto Kevin Durant. And that's a shame for Kevin Durant. So, you know, tough times. They don't have a lot of flexibility in terms of their cap and going out and making other moves. They're sort of stuck with Ben Simmons. No one's going to trade for him. So, you know, it's pretty bleak here for sure. This is not how they pictured it going. You know, coming into the year, the two teams that were favored to win the title were the Nets and the Lakers, and their parallels this season have been very, very eerie. Now, that's created a vacuum for some really fun younger teams, Boston, Milwaukee. You know, Golden State's got an injection of youth with Jordan Poole. You know, the list goes on. And so, you know, it's an unpredictable playoffs, but it's definitely been one, you know, it's been kind of a stage for some of these other, you know, teams that are non-marquee markets or younger players without that established, you know, reputation in postseason moments to kind of get a taste of the limelight. I mean, that Memphis-Minnesota series, a perfect example. Yeah, young players in every direction, all trying to establish themselves, you know, going at each other's throat, the trash talking between the dads and everything else. That's something that we just haven't really seen in a big time way these last few years. And it's been really fun to watch.
Now, for those listening that do not know, you know, obviously Ben been successful in every avenue, but his first start was the draftkevindurant.com. So he's a big KD fan. I have to throw this KD take by you, essentially. Is of the top, you know, regarded 15, 20 players of all time, how many more of them, like, have more excuses than Kevin Durant does. At first, it was that the Thunder are too young. Then they had the James Harden trade. They hid behind that. Then there was the Westbrook injury, the Kevin Durant injury himself. Then the problem now has become, well, he had to play with Westbrook the entire time. I just feel like for a guy who's a top 15 player of all time, it's weird that his crowning achievement, other than the Warriors time, is like, man, he was really good in a second round series. He's just had a lot of ugly playoff moments. His true shooting percentage has dropped off by 7% during that. His turnovers have gone up slightly, as are his fouls. I love Kevin Durant. I think he's very good. But at a certain point, I just think it's weird that he's been able to claim the mantle of best player alive for the last year and a half without really any results.
Well, saying other than the Golden State era, which was the best basketball era arguably ever, and, you know, certainly the best era we've seen post-Jordan, I think that's a little bit of a misrepresentation. I mean, look, he gets credit for that. He was, you know, obviously he wasn't the first one there, but he was the straw that broke everybody's back and made the entire league whine about how unfair it was that they had such a great collection of talent. You know, two titles there, heroic a comeback attempt that almost led to another, two finals MVPs, outdoing LeBron on big stages. Was LeBron still a better player at that point? I would say yes, but look, the three-pointers in LeBron's eyes still count. They're still going to be on YouTube for all time, right? Now, is there some aspect of Kevin Durant's career that leaves us all feeling unfulfilled? Absolutely. I mean, you also left out the fact that he had a crazy Achilles injury, and you know, that is typically a career altering turn of events. And for Kevin to come back and play at a high level where he could be in the conversation as the best player, one of the top two or three players, is pretty crazy. And I'm not sure he gets enough credit for that, especially because of how poorly Brooklyn has managed his return in terms of just throwing him into the deep end and asking him to play 40 plus minutes every single night. Did I expect more from Kevin and his career once he first got to Golden State? Absolutely. You know, I mean, that should have been a 7-year run, you know, to rival the Showtime Lakers of the 80s, or, you know, to kind of put yourself in that category with like the Celtics from the 60s. The entire table was set for him, and I think it was set too perfectly, and that might have been what bothered him. He tends to be a guy who likes to stay on the move, who's never quite satisfied. You know, never fully wanting to, like, you know, put down roots and all those things. And at the end of that time in Golden State, I felt like he was looking for reasons to not be happy when he should have just been saying, look, Steph and I can own this league for the next 6 or 7 years. The decision to team up with Kyrie Irving over Steph Curry that summer was completely baffling. It made no sense whatsoever from a basketball standpoint. And so for a guy who loves and preaches how much he's always, you know, cared about basketball and how he's a real hooper and all that, to let friendships or egos or relationships or business interests or the desire to move back east or whatever else to kind of come before basketball, to me, it was just disappointing because he just, you know, as I called it at the time, he just wanted to play buddy ball. He just wanted to hang out with his friends. And that's not the best formula, as we've seen, for winning championships. So, look, he's going to – I think his case as one of the all-time greats is pretty unassailable when you're looking at how much he's accumulated and how much more he can accumulate. But he absolutely his career has left me wanting more on his behalf. And I also think that, you know, no Achilles injury, some of this stuff would have played out differently. He would have been even better than he's shown.
Yeah, I think it's fair. I think historically, it almost reminds me of another great small forward. When you kind of track the trajectory of like a Julius Erving's career, it's like, you know, he had the accolades with the ABA. He won an MVP as well. But a lot of time people will now be like, oh, well, Moses won that title, which is not totally fair. The 83 Sixers. And yeah, I kind of have KD right around that, you know, 15 to 10 range where he was my favorite player growing up. I would say he's probably the most talented, you know, as far, I know you hate the Kyrie talented, skilled discussion, but KD, you just watch him, you're like, wow, I've never seen anything like that. And yeah, I will always remember your eulogy of Kevin Durant's career once he signed with the Nets.
And you were right about that, Ben. Yeah.
You were dead on.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was, honestly, that one was kind of an easy call. I mean, you have to look at Kyrie's track record and just start with availability and start with reliability. and start with all the things that aren't flashy moves and clutch basket in the finals and everything else. I mean, there's been a real myth built up around Kyrie Irving. He's tried to propagate that myth as strong as anybody, you know, putting himself in the mama mentality school and all this stuff. And you just kind of have to see through some of that and say, like, well, what have you actually done? And his track record of accomplishments is a far, far less than Kevin's. And it's crazy to me that anyone would call Kyrie Irving the most skilled player ever when he's not even the most skilled player on his own team. Now, in terms of some of those excuses you mentioned earlier, the Westbrook one's a legit excuse, man. I mean, that guy has been an issue the whole way through.
The decision I did like Kevin making
was trading Westbrook for Steph Curry. And that's why that was part of the reason why I was so dumbfounded that he then traded Curry for Irving, because the Westbrook thing to me was never going to work out. It was always going to be a brick wall every time they got to the playoffs and Westbrook gets himself into spots where he just can't get it done, or he overheats in late game moments. And, he was defensive issues in terms of discipline were a problem for him the whole way through. And to find a player who was so much more refined in Curry, who was so much more unselfish and able to share the stage and so much more just reliable night to night, so much more explosive as a shooter. It was like, what a great trade, Kevin. You know, you've really set yourself up here for a long time. And I guess, you know, you just wound up taking it for granted, and I'll never understand that.
That's fair. I think some of it, and obviously you were not saying this, and I hate to even sound close to a Westbrook defender. I feel like in retrospect, now people try to paint it as like KD was stuck playing with Eric Bledsoe his first 7 years, which, you know, right. is just unfair. But yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, as far as if you look at Steph Curry is probably the most scalable superstar of all time, and Westbrook's probably the least scalable. That was a great career decision. I think there are certain times, and like a lot of times, you know, they ran up against the Spurs, which are, you know, those 13, 14, 15 Spurs teams are like all-time great teams. So I think there's reasons why it didn't work out for Kevin Durant. I just think it's a little strange that it never comes up, or it all gets placed on Westbrook or ownership or Kendrick Perkins with like an all-time great player. I think it's a little peculiar.
No. It's a fair point. And look, all I'm saying is Westbrook wasn't going to keep them from being a playoff team, right? He was just going to be a guy where, like, you're not going to win the title with them. At some point, something is going to go wrong. Someone's going to be able to exploit him. And if Kevin had stayed for the next 5 years, I don't think he'd have any rings. That's kind of my basic contention. But some of that does fall on Kevin's shoulders. What you will see occasionally from him is over deference, you know, and he has this easy money sniper label, and he's hit a lot of big shots. He's a great late game assassin. Get him the basketball, he can get a shot on basically anybody, right? But there's definitely been moments, even going back to like the 2016 Olympics, you know, Kevin's kind of like a bystander to his own reality. He's a little bit too passive. I mean, even at times in the Olympics 2016, he was like that as well. And it always drives me crazy when he doesn't get to have the ball in the key moments, or he's not, you know, taking over control of the action. He's not sort of in the driver's seat when his team is struggling and when he just kind of watches. And unfortunately, that was a huge problem in Oklahoma City, him watching Westbrook too much. And look, if you give Westbrook the ball, he's fine to take it, right? And it's been the same thing with Kyrie Irving in Brooklyn. I mean, throughout this series, I would call this the most disappointing series of Kevin's entire career, because he's let Kyrie kind of run the whole show. Even when Kyrie was in foul trouble the other night, he really wasn't exerting himself. Bruce Brown's playing twice as hard as Kevin is, probably because Kevin's exhausted, and he does have to own that. And so when you are looking forward to next year's, you know, top 100 or top player rankings, I mean, Kevin can't be one. I think most people would agree with that. And a big part of his case for being number one this past year was he did take control of that entire series last year against Milwaukee when Kyrie and Harden were injured. He outplayed Giannis, and then he outplayed everybody in Tokyo by a substantial margin to win a gold medal. So I do think he had a strong case as the number one player this past year. But injuries, age, fatigue, and then, you know, a return of some of the bad habits that you were talking about in terms of being too deferential have definitely kind of cost him on this year's list. And you know, it's interesting. Like, who would you have, Luka or KD, for next year? You know, I'm thinking pretty hard about Luka.
Ooh, that's a hot take. Yeah, Jazz series plays out.
Yeah, you're asking the wrong guy. I'm a little lower on Luka, even though I just said all that about KD. would still ride with him, but would have to think about it. Just not totally sold. I'm not as bad as Andrew Sharp is on Luka, but still have my questions. Just reminds me a little, like, the heliocentric style, really more so than he is a player, I guess I have questions about.
Well, it's funny. You can't have it both ways, man. You can't be mad at KD for not doing too much and then mad at Luka for doing too much. You know what I mean? It's one or the other, so you got to pick a side.
All right, so that gets us into sort of the other playoff series. You know, Giannis, I think, is kind of most people's clear number one, especially after the way this series has played out. There have been a lot of injuries in this playoffs, Ben. Which one do you think is going to have the biggest impact? Embiid, Middleton, or Booker? I think, you know, after last night's game, the answer might be Booker. We'll see how this Pelicans-Suns game plays out. But the Middleton injury could cost the Bucks when they're playing what I think would be the favorite in the East at this point, the Celtics, considering how they've handled this series.
Yeah, I think you've hit on the two answers. I mean, for sure, Phoenix is in much more trouble than I expected against New Orleans, even without Booker. And, you know, Chris Paul's, like, vast ups and downs in this series have got to make you very nervous because, you know, now it's a best of three. If he no-shows one more time, I mean, you're really playing with fire there, right? And it's not that Chris Paul is somehow not made for the moment. I mean, he's an incredible late-game player, has been for these last couple of years in Phoenix especially. But he's old. He can wear it down. They're making him work. I mean, the Jose Alvarado stuff used to be kind of a cute story, right? That was a big-time impact in game four, just him making Chris Paul work to bring the basketball up the court and just kind of struggling and not really having a lot of answers from a quickness and athleticism perspective. Got to be pretty scary if you're a Suns fan. The Middleton thing to me is huge. Boston is the favorite right now to come out of the East, absolutely, in my mind. Their defense is just unbelievable. And what we're seeing against KD is that they've been able to kind of load up on him, you know, show extra bodies, be physical with him and everything else. And there hasn't really been a counter from Brooklyn. And I think, you know, from Giannis, you don't have to worry about him standing passively around the perimeter. Like, the worst case scenario for him is he responds to extra defensive attention by being, you know, too aggressive, going to the basket, getting himself in foul trouble and all that. But the Celtics have lots of size and length that can bother teams defensively. They just got Rob Williams back. That's going to be a key piece their overall scheme against Giannis. And if you don't have Chris Middleton to be kind of a source of late game offense off the dribble shooting, or just balancing your own half court offense against Giannis, right, so that he doesn't have to do everything, I just think there's going to be some weak links, you know, poking through. And on the flip side, you need to have somebody to guard Tatum. That was most likely going to be Middleton's responsibility, right? Tatum's been playing out of his mind. I mean, that kind of got lost in game three, but he had almost 40 points and was, you know, having a answer for everything, you know, the Brooklyn was trying to do defensively. It's just a killer loss there. And so I actually think both of them eventually are going to come back to bite those two teams. You know, unless Booker can get back on the court, it sounds like Middleton's going to be out for a bit. And I do think, you know, coming into the playoffs, I had Milwaukee over Boston. But you factor in how well Boston's played in the first round and then the Middleton injury, and I take Boston over Milwaukee now, probably in six games.
Yeah, it's a big victory for advanced analytics here, Ben. Early in the season, like 538 had the Celtics as the highest odds to win the East, and everybody was like, what is going on over there? What numbers are they crunching into the calculator to get that out of the equation? But it makes sense now. The Celtics, I think, are the favorites in the East, like we've all said.
Yeah, don't go too far with that, though. Those 538 guys are throwing darts, man. I mean, they have some weird stuff every year. You know, broken clocks right twice a day. So we'll give it to them this year. But come on, man. Let's not go crazy.
They used to love those DeRozan Raptors teams. Those were always there. Giles, this is kind of my galaxy brain take on the Celtics. You know, I'm not a green beer drinker by any means. I think I've been with, you know, I've been hating on the Celtics for the last 10 years. Not a fun team to root for. And for whatever reason, this season, like, you know, probably around February, it started to click. I was like, I actually kind of like this team. Like, I found myself rooting for Marcus Smart. And I feel like because Danny Ainge and Brad Stevens are no longer in the picture, it doesn't feel as bad. They're removed from the Kyrie stink. They have Robert Williams, who, even though he's in his third season or fourth season, you know, it's starting to come around. I feel crazy, but the only worry I have with the Celtics team, as much as I love Milwaukee, is do you think that Robert Williams, that meniscus tear, does that scare you at all? Because I know, you know, you're a Portland guy and Brandon Roy had the same injury and also came back too soon and kind of impeded his career.
Well, first of all, speaking of Portland, I mean, you have just proven that you can't withstand the seductive power of Ime Udoka, one of America's probably 10 coolest people. And don't forget where Ime Udoka is from. That's right, Portland, Oregon. So if Boston is now cool again, I would give all credit to Ime. And certainly I'm not surprised it took a Portlander to kind of clean up New England. Now, in terms of the thing on the meniscus, you know, it's a very unselfish move by the players to come back that quickly. For Brandon Roy, in his mind, he was already concerned, how many more runs am I going to have? And so it was worth it to him to have, you know, what he considered to be kind of like a run in his prime, even if it meant sacrificing something on the back end. That was a very disputed decision at the time. And I don't think outsiders realized just how bad his knees were, because I think already in his mind, he was wondering, like, how many more of these am I even going to get? You know, I might as well just kind of seize the moment. Now, that's not really the case with Rob Williams, right? I mean, as far as I know, fairly clean injury history, young guy, you know, and hasn't really gotten a big contract yet. So I give him credit for being willing to do it. And I do think that if Boston wasn't on track potentially to win a title, his calculus might be different, right? I think that the vibes are so good around the Celtics right now, and it's crazy to say this because the vibes were terrible in December, and they were really bad last year too. I think it's just a magnetic situation where it's like, I want to get back on the court and help these guys. I want to do my part. We're about to do something special. And so that doesn't mean you throw caution to the wind, but I do think it means that you're willing to make that kind of a you know, career altering choice, or a choice with real stakes, because you're going to see a benefit and a payoff. And I think a lot of guys in his situation, if they win a title, even if there is some ramification down the road, he might view it still as being worth it. You know, it's kind of an individual decision. You can put yourself in his spot and say, well, are we ever going to get a shot as good as this one, where our defense is clicking like this, and we've got so much talent and guys on reasonable contracts? I mean, this is kind of the carpe diem moment, especially because players change teams now so frequently, and guys get paid. And so, you know, organizations have to make decisions on them. I could see why he would want to hustle back. And, I think if, you know, you hate to kind of project, but like, I view myself more as a Robert Williams type than a Ben Simmons type. I just don't understand how Ben Simmons can sit there and watch all these games all year long from the bench and not feel the tug to be back out there. And, you know, surprise, surprise, he's not going to play in game four. Shocking. Who could have guessed, right? So I don't want to, you know, make Robert Williams into be this hero and this martyr and this great, amazing guy, but I generally prefer guys who play to guys who don't.
Availability is the greatest ability.
Availability is
yes, sir. You got it.
Yep. So let's talk about the T-Wolves versus Grizzlies series, tied 2-2. I didn't think this series was going to be this close. I don't think you did either, Ben. But Tim did. Tim picked the T-Wolves beforehand, out of nowhere. Last year, when the rookie of the year conversation was going on, we were, you know, we pretty much hated Anthony Edwards because we hated all the arguments that were for him to win rookie of the year. And that was all that we had last year was, you know, LaMelo rookie of the year. That was our big driving cause for the podcast. But, you know, now it's getting, I have to say, it's getting a little bit close between those two players. I think that prior to this, like, postseason run by Anthony Edwards, it was clearly LaMelo out of that class. Where do you stand now, Ben, between those two players? Who would you rather have?
Well, first of all, where do you guys stand? Who's willing to be Benedict Arnold here? Anybody?
No.
I will say I understand the ball watcher's take of, like, when you do watch Anthony Edwards score 32, I mean, it's one of the most exciting 32 points in the league. But, I mean, there's a lot to want. Like, I see the first step. I see the 3-point potential, but I'm still LaMelo, but I have moved over a little bit on the spectrum, I will say.
Yeah, swayed a little bit towards Anthony Edwards, but what LaMelo can do in terms of his passing ability, Anthony Edwards does not have. Edwards is probably a better scorer. He definitely is a better scorer at this point. Yeah, he's definitely a better scorer. And like you mentioned, the first step is, like, incredible. But I think if LaMelo had the same supporting cast, you know, the narrative could very easily be, oh, look at what LaMelo is doing in the postseason this year. Whereas Anthony Edwards is playing with Cat and D'Angelo Russell. LaMelo doesn't have quite that same level of supporting cast around him. And if he were in a playoff series, I think he'd be doing the exact same thing. But yeah, curious to get your take, Ben.
Well, I think that Anthony Edwards still has a lot of work in progress to make on the defensive end, but I think LaMelo has even more. And so if I'm saying right now, which of those guys would I prefer in the playoffs or prefer at this particular moment, I would say Anthony Edwards. But that goes against the general archetype that I'm looking for, which is, you know, lead ball handlers who make their teammates better. And I'm not really convinced Anthony Edwards does that. And that's not like a strike against him for all time. I just think that he is like a pure scorer, bucket getter. He's a, you know, a very streaky with high ceiling potential as a 3-point shooter as well. And so he can win games for you almost single-handedly. It's hard to win a title single-handedly, right? And if you have a lead playmaker who can score the basketball, shoot it off the dribble, and is an elite passer who's committed to the team concept and willing to keep everybody involved, that is a more desirable profile to me. But I do want to see more progress from LaMelo and just kind of more discipline in terms of how he continues to grow. Not that he's behind schedule by any sense. I think you guys are right. Compared to what expectations were before the draft, it was a strong argument LaMelo is actually ahead of schedule because people thought that first year was going to be a write-off, and he's already an all-star. So that's great. But right now, I'll be honest, I don't love either one of them. I guess I would default to Edwards at this point, but still prefer LaMelo as a long-term prospect. But, you know, they're also both exceedingly young. And the good part is they're getting their feet wet early. You know, I mean, there's sometimes guys aren't playing meaningful basketball until the end of their rookie contracts. And so that's what's exciting about that particular group. I mean, you know, like Wiseman, for example, like he hasn't even played a minute that matters. And he's going into year three next year. So for these guys to have thousands of minutes under their belt, some big game moments, you know, Melo in the play-in games and Edwards in this first round series, which has just been total chaos and really funny to watch. That's great in terms of where, the, you know, projecting 2-3 years down the road, you're going to look back and these players are going to be a lot better and more refined than they are right now.
Yeah. Anthony Edwards versus LaMelo is a question right now. What's bugged me a little bit with the narrative recently has been that it's Anthony Edwards versus Ja Morant in this series, whereas Ja's supporting cast, again, is not as good as Edwards is with the star players.
That's why they won 20 games without him. Ben, I have to say, you are the catalyst for, not the full catalyst for my Ja Morant hate, but remember earlier this year when he came and he toured the two LA teams and he was electric? You anointed him the point guard in waiting. And, you know I have my biases towards LaMelo. I mean, I'm not gonna lie about that. But I genuinely just don't believe that Ja Morant is a better player than Trae Young going forward. I just think that, you know, you look at Ja Morant and the Grizzlies, big part of this, in the regular season, top two in both offensive and defensive efficiency in transition. But I just look at Ja Morant as a guy who needs to hold the ball. I wouldn't compare him to Westbrook because he's not a chucker like that. But I just worry about a guy who's shooting below 30% from three in the playoffs, and he's only at 47% in the rim. I just wonder how, like, you know, would the next Kevin Durant want to team up with Ja Morant?
I actually think Kevin Durant loves Ja Morant's game. I'm pretty sure he said that, but it's an interesting question. It's always easier to, the grass is always greener, right? When you don't have to play with someone, it's easier to appreciate a rival than it is to you appreciate your own teammate, because when he's your teammate, you have to deal with his weaknesses. When he's your rival, you get to just kind of enjoy his strengths and then exploit his weaknesses when you get to play him head to head. I think that this wave of jaw backlash is some of the silliest stuff I can remember seeing. Not trying to call you out. You're not the worst defender here by any stretch. You know, I've seen a lot of it growing on social media. I think, first of all, he's had a better playoff series than Trae Young, and this has been his worst moment of his career, being Ja Morant. You know, I think, second of all, people are forgetting he's coming off an extended injury absence. He made the comment the other night, he doesn't feel like himself kind of going to the basket. He's been getting a lot of his shots blocked, which isn't necessarily unusual, but he doesn't seem to have the same spring that he did earlier this year. And I think the biggest, there's two big concerns with Ja going forward. One, he has just got to get better and more imposing somehow on defense, whether that means being, you know, a pest on the ball, or just being stronger when, you know, guys are trying to, you know, get you into an island situation, he's got to show improvement there. And I'm sure he will, because he can't get much worse, right? You know, the other thing that, you know, Ja's going to have to do, though, is fill out the offensive profile like you described with the shooting, but don't shortchange what he's able to do well, which is get by his man every single possession, draw two, draw three. And Minnesota is showing him a ton of help, traps in those kinds of situations. And so he may not get box score credit for some of the assists, but he is the focal point of basically everything that they're doing on offense. And, you know, he makes smart passes, and he's a lot more unselfish than you're giving him credit for. He's actually a pass first player, not a score first player. Even though he had the big scoring number this year, he wants to keep everybody involved. And he does need to have the ball in his hands. There's no question there. But good things happen when he's going downhill, whether he's getting to the free throw line, getting to the rim, or kind of setting up the passes to free guys like Dylan Brooks, you know, or Desmond Bain. So it's been a kind of a tough series, trial by fire for Ja. I don't think he's completely healthy. He's going to have to really get his body into a better place so he can withstand the punishment that he puts on it. But I still think sky's the limit for him. And I think he's been better in this series than some people are willing to give him credit for, because there's been a lot of focus on the shooting percentages. When you go back to that crazy game three where they have the big comebacks multiple times, his fingerprints are on a lot of those comebacks in terms of the shots guys are creating. And even the other night, game four, I mean, he was pretty bad in game four, but who set up Tyus Jones for a wide open three-pointer that would have completely changed that game in the closing seconds? You know, Ja was the one who set that up. He's great at grabbing defensive rebounds, pushing in transition, catching you napping, and everything else. So I think it's been a great matchup with Minnesota. They've certainly rose to the occasion. And I would actually say Ja has the better cast of teammates than Anthony Edwards. You go top to bottom, you know, I would definitely take Memphis's roster over Minnesota's. And a guy like D'Angelo Russell, to me, has actually been worse than Ja in this series. And it seems like people are kind of overlooking that as well. So I hope it goes seven. I might try to sneak onto that series if it does go seven and maybe see the last game, depending on how this Nets series goes. But don't write off Ja. You know, don't judge him on his worst day. And this series has not been his best moment.
You probably were taken aback a little bit there, Ben, by the animosity between me and Tim, because we've gone back and forth between Ja and Trey on this podcast all year, where I've been picking Ja and he's been picking Trey. And I've had my moment in the sun where Ja was clearly outperforming Trey in the regular season. And now Tim just wants to shine a little bit with the Trey Young side.
Yeah, I'll be fully transparent. I mean, it was a backlash response. I didn't come into the season like that. But as soon as I heard, like, you know, everyone was just anointing him, and I just kind of questioned the uber athletic point guard, you know, who's 22 years old. I have a fancy for Trey. I will admit I'm biased towards that, but yeah, it did make me wonder. And yeah, I know that this is not representative of who Ja is as a player, but you know, have to get my stickling in while I can.
No, for sure. Well, here's what I recommend for you. Go to the Grizzlies game next time they're in Charlotte, because part of the Ja experience is seeing it in person and just getting the goosebumps from some of the moves that he makes. The guy is so tiny, you know, much like Trey. That's really how you can compare them. Smallest, skinniest guys on the court, and yet they make all these giants around them just look totally hopeless with some of their quickness and their craft, and just their skill level is just exquisite. So, you know, I would recommend going to see him in person and see maybe if some of the backlash wanes a little bit and you start to say, oh, I know what these guys are talking about. The Trey stuff has been interesting. So as a big pro Trey guy, are you giving all the credit to Miami's defense, which has been excellent in this series? Are you blaming his supporting cast? Because, I mean, like, who do you even go to, you know, to kind of help relieve the pressure? Or do you put any of this on Trey himself? Because it's been a bad series. I did not expect it to be this bad.
I like to consider myself a reality-based person like you.
Good.
So I like to add some nuance to it. I was not a believer last year in, like, oh, his squad is so good, because I was like, I've seen Danilo Gallinari since he was in New York. I was like, nah, not that big of a fan. People are like, well, Trey's not a winner because Cam Reddish and John Collins don't like him. I never really bought that, and I don't think that Nate McMillan, as you know, Portland guy, I don't think he's like this great head coach. He has been very disappointing in this playoff series, though. I mean, obviously, it was a little bit of fool's gold going up against a favorable matchup against New York. And even Philly last year, where they run, you know, heavy drop coverage with Joel. So, like, I think that the truth with Trey is somewhere in the middle of these playoffs, but he has been deplorably bad. I will not deny that. But I still have hope. I just view him as someone who, as an offensive centerpiece, you can really, I think you're very flexible to build around him. Obviously, you need defensive guys like Hunter and Capella last year, not this season. But I just think as someone that can shoot and pass as well as he can, even though I was bashing on the heliocentric players earlier, I think for the regular season, it's more dependable. But yes, I mean, I think there are very real questions about Ja and Trey in the playoffs. And just, you know, like there was the Lou Williams theory, what I would say, with foul drawing in the playoffs for smaller guards, where it's not dependable. This year, it's kind of swayed on the opposite side of the pendulum, where fouls are up. But I do worry about Trey in the playoffs, I will say. This is more a regular season-based take.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that this debate is really going to be shaped a lot by their supporting cast over the next 5 years. And, you know, for a while there, it looked like Atlanta had this great squad of young guys, DeAndre Hunter and Cam Reddish, all these guys who were going to grow up with Trey, right? Those guys have not really panned out like we were hoping, really at all. And then you look over at Ja in Memphis. I mean, that team has the whole team practically besides Adams is young. They're all growing together. You know, they've got an owner who can afford to keep kind of the players that he wants to keep. And they seem like they all gel and like each other. So I think that, you know, if you're looking at a 5-year window, you know, put aside their individual games, just like who's set up better for success, I would put Memphis way above Atlanta on this one. And that could actually wind up being unfair to Trey. You know, it could be one of those things where he just winds up getting stranded in the play-in range or first round exits. And everybody just says, oh, the Eastern Conference Finals trip was a mirage. You know, it was kind of a weird COVID year or whatever else. While Memphis is maybe making, you know, more deep runs here over the next 5 years and Ja's getting the credit for it. So I hate when that happens. It's sort of like the Embiid versus Jokic thing right now, right? It's like Jokic has to play a much tougher team. That's a much worse matchup for centers. And he's got absolutely no help whatsoever on this Denver roster. Embiid gets to play an easy team in Toronto. He's got three players on his team you'd prefer to have over anybody on Denver's roster. And all of a sudden, everybody's judging Jokic based on none of those other factors, right? And I could see, you know, Trey actually being in a similar spot to Jokic here, say, 2 years down the road.
Yeah, you know, referencing that that Toronto-Philly series and the Jokic Embiid debate, I feel like, you know, Draymond had the famous post-game press conference a couple of years ago. I think the DeMarcus Cousins year, the Warriors, where he's like, there are 82-game players and there are 16-game players. And, you know, there's been the debate between, you know, like the difference between regular season basketball, postseason basketball. I think the first time I remember it was Roy Hibbert, when Paro Antic gave them trouble in the first round. And I just wanted to get your take. How legitimate do you think the regular season versus postseason difference is? And how much of that was just kind of the Warriors run of like these bigs being run off the floor? Or do you think that's something that's here to stay?
Well, don't forget there's 82 game players. There's 16 game players. There's also 4 game players like Kyrie Irving, where if you put your faith in them, you're going to get swept out in the first round. So don't forget about that category. I've actually been saving that line. So you guys, I tested it out on you first.
Yeah, it was good. It was good.
No, it's a real thing, man. It's definitely a real thing. Versatility in a position, multi-positional ability for big guys is unavoidably important during the playoffs. And during the regular season, what you see a lot of teams do is just buy minutes for their best players by playing the big hulks and asking them to do all the dirty work, right? And so it's just a way of managing that whole season. And once you get to the end, it is a different style of play. You know, I think that there's another debate about like, well, do three-point shooters matter more in the regular season compared to the playoffs, right? Or do you need to have shot creators and tough two-makers and all that? You know, I think in general, if you can, you know, it kind of goes back to the Bob Myers quote of like, you need people with as few weaknesses as possible, right? So you want triple threats on offense, you know, guys who can shoot, pass, and dribble, right? Create their own shot. You want defensive players who can switch, but who can also, you know, protect the paint, right? And there's no magic formula here, though. I mean, look at Milwaukee last year. I mean, Brook Lopez, they win a title. That guy's a pretty traditional center. He was viewed as slow his entire life until he was drinking champagne out of the Larry O'Brien trophy, right? And he's still slow, but he still won a title. And there's a few other cases like that. I mean, Golden State's a great example. They were playing centers. You know, they would switch to the depth lineup, but they always had kind of traditional centers, Bogut and Looney, at various points of their run as well. So there's a role for those guys. Berzhau, yeah. And others too. I mean, Festus Ezeli, maybe not the most successful stint, you know, for that particular role, but
game seven will live in infamy.
Right. So there's a spot for those guys, but for sure the versatility aspect is even more important in the playoffs than during the regular season.
So the Hornets need a center here, Ben. I want to get your take on this. Tim's thrown it out into the ether. He wants us to trade for Rudy Gobert this offseason. Rudy Gobert is kind of the classic example, I think, of a player who's very good in the regular season, defensive player of the year, all that. But then the postseason has been exposed kind of year after year. But in Charlotte, we don't particularly care about the playoffs that much. We just want to make the playoffs, Ben. So Rudy Gobert would definitely help us do that.
Yeah, no, I saw a tweet a couple months ago. It was from some, I don't know, hot take guy or whatever. And he said something like, Russell Westbrook will guarantee you a playoff spot if the Orlando Magic trade for him. And then Russell Westbrook's wife retweeted it and was like, facts. she meant to say Rudy Gobert, not Russell Westbrook. She just got kind of confused there. Because if a team like Orlando or Charlotte or Washington, right, that kind of a team, if they traded for Rudy Gobert, he would lift their floor high enough to make the playoffs in the Eastern Conference solely by being a guy who could give you basically a top seven or eight defense by himself. And depending on what other personnel you have, maybe even better than that, because he is for sure an 82 game player. That's kind of how he keeps racking up defensive player of the year and all defense selections, right? For Charlotte, it's a gigantic hole, and it's been a huge, when was the last good center you guys had? Honestly,
Al Jefferson.
And he was not a defensive forward. I mean, you would probably have to go back to when we traded. I guess we had Vlade Divac for 1 year from the Kobe trade. That was probably our best two-way center since Alonzo Mourning. It's dark.
Tyson Chandler
I was not prepared for those really sad answers. I don't open-ended rhetorical question with just awful answers. Al Jefferson was an early guy you guys would have loved, you know, in terms of the analytic battles about him. I don't know if you guys were old enough for that. Always incredible box score numbers, always kind of in the all-star mix, you know, with 2010s. And then the defense was so bad, like you just mentioned, that a lot of people would just kind of harp on him as just being like, actually, he's worthless. All he's doing is filling the stat sheet and not giving you anything you need. That was a 2 or 3 year long debate, I remember. So yeah, I might want to go back further than Al Jefferson in terms of like who's the guy who you could really imagine succeeding in this particular era for this group. So I would be all for it. You know, you're kind of buying low on Rudy as well, you know, just because Utah's kind of blowing up. You know, you don't have enough other defensive talent in terms of plus defenders to be able to just kind of scheme it, you know, and to try to get by. You've tried that in the past, it just hasn't worked. I would be willing to do that if I was Charlotte for sure. Now, the only trick is, you know, he does kind of screw up spacing on offense. There's really no way around it. You can keep him involved with the high screen and roll, and, you know, LaMelo would be throwing lob passes to him like crazy, and that would work. But, you know, you would have to make sure basically everybody else in your starting lineup is a 3-point threat to just make sure you're not getting too crowded, because you can see the Gobert effect with Mitchell and Conley. Like, those guys can just, you know, really struggle to get to the basket during these playoffs when he's on the court. And that's partly their fault, but it's also just kind of partly the nature of playing with Gobert.
Cool. That's I guess the question would be, what do we have to give back? Like Gordon Hayward in 2 first-round picks for Rudy Gobert? Hopefully it happens this offseason.
I do it. I mean, that's a bad contract from Hayward. You got to just kind of give up. I mean, it was a very big risk to get him in the first place. You know, it was kind of a swing and ultimately a miss. You know, it's kind of Birmingham Barons MJ. And if it's first round picks that you're not expecting to be like top eight selections based on, you know, how good LaMelo is, put some protections on it. And I'd do that for sure.
Just to reference again how poor our center play has been, when we traded Gerald Wallace, our franchise player, to Portland, we got Joel Prisbilla coming off a micro fracture surgery.
Oh, yeah.
Like, ooh, I was like, man, that's pretty promising. That could be good. So yes, it's we're deprived down here. Yeah, we'll take Clint Capella off of knee surgery. We'll do whatever we want. And you know, I was really big on the Gobert thing.
Oh, Biyombo.
Biyombo's come back twice. That's the thing. It's like, you know, he left for a couple years and we were like, man, Biyombo wants $16 million a year. Wow. Like, you know, that could really do something. He was our leading center in minutes last year because Cody Zeller's always hurts. But yeah, I do have to say, I love the Terry Stotts plan. Cause I think that's where we will be going, is banking very heavily on offense. And I thought that Gobert could work out because I was like, okay, he gets exposed in the playoffs, but I kind of tried to deny that. And then I saw Jalen Brunson and Spencer Dinwiddie lighting him up, and I was like, all right, maybe we should make this trade.
Well, it's all about your goals, right? Like, you know, you want to walk before you can run. If MJ is intent on, we have to make the playoffs, that's a very reasonable way to go about doing it. And now you've got LaMelo in a spot where, hey, he's getting valuable minutes for these next couple of years. You're kind of penciled in. Maybe you're losing in the first round, but that's better than getting blown out in the play-in. And, you know, Rudy Gobert is not like a 10-year plan. I mean, that's a 3 or 4 year plan, right? And then at that point, LaMelo is in his prime and you're maybe needing like a one-man defense a little bit less because, you know, you've got your best player, you know, playing like a franchise-level guy. So I like it. Personally, and if you had Terry Stotts from the offense, Rudy Gobert to handle all the defense, and everybody else is just like freak athletes, you know, putting together highlights, that sounds like pretty fun, and it sounds like good podcasting material.
Yeah, we're in. All right, Ben, I want to get you out of here. Tell the people where they can check out your work, where they can hear your podcast and your work at the Washington Post.
Yeah, WashingtonPost.com/sports, just doing all sorts of playoff stuff these days, and greatestofalltalk.com for the podcast. We're putting out 2 a week. And we'll probably be responding to this Game 4 disaster or looming disaster here between Brooklyn and Boston later this week. So check it out.
Will Andrew be at Game 4 as well? Or was he just at Game 3?
No, look, I think that Kevin Durant owes him gas money, you know, for the drive up from DC. And so I think he just got out of Dodge as quickly as possible. You know, Andrew has a real day job. You know, he actually has to like, you know, work for a living. So I think that duty called on that front, but it was great to see him. I think it was the first time we've seen each other during the pandemic on Saturday night. You know, people were calling him out because he showed up wearing neutral maroon or burgundy sweatshirt rather than cheering for either the Celtics or the Nets. You know, he jumps on every bandwagon. So I thought maybe he'd be one of those guys who has like a split jersey. You know what I mean? And it's like half of like an Enes Kanter jersey and half of an Andre Drummond jersey, but he didn't go that direction. He just went full Switzerland with the maroon sweatshirt. And I think he probably went home disappointed because that's a long drive to watch a 4-game player in Kyrie Irving not step up and to watch one of the worst games I've ever seen Kevin Durant play when the stakes were high.
You got to really give Andrew some gruff because he's the biggest Celtics fan in national media outside of like Bill Simmons. And now he's going to turn his back on it. But yeah, I would implore all of our listeners to check out the GOAT podcast. It's honestly why Mark and I started this podcast back when you guys were at Sports Illustrated. I showed it to Mark one time after you guys were discussing, I think, the Victor Oladipo injury. That's how long ago it was. Wow. On the Pacers. But yeah, I mean, been there since the jump. Yeah, so everyone should check it out. Ben is truly the best in the business. Not to embarrass him while he's on the call.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, guys. I had a great time chatting with you. I wish you luck in your coaching search. I wish you all the prosperity in future LaMelo debates. And I hope you come around on job, my guy.
I'll grow up one day. You kind of talked me into it a little bit, but I won't admit it for another 16 months.
I'll talk him into it, Ben. Thanks for joining.
My pleasure. Take care, guys. Much.